case of the frozen pussy, slip or trip, the $1 million fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will find on the Miami Memoirs podcast. Strange Cases and Wild Tales presents real case histories and true stories related to the law practice and experiences of a creative Florida attorney reaching out over 60 years. There's more than meets the eye. In these sparkling memoirs, Florida attorney Louis Ress uncorks a caseload of true, weird, wonderful, and wild stories from an always eventful 6 decades of life in the law. Before we begin, I would like to tell you about a new book from Louis. Miami Memoirs, including The Maharani's Ring, Round 2 from the Amazing Life and Times of Legendary South Florida Attorney Louis Ress, takes readers from Brooklyn in the 1940s, via a spell in a top-secret army department, and a transatlantic solo flight in a replica Spirit of St. Louis, to adventures in and out of the courtroom in a sometimes rougher-than-ready 50s and 60s Miami. The book is available on Amazon, just search Louis Ress. And now let's begin.
Hi everyone, welcome to Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Louis Ress. Today we'll be doing episode 32, Larry the First. Can you tell us a little bit about what this story is going to be about? I want to know who Larry is.
Larry, well, there was a whole series of books and broadcasts about the most unforgettable character I've ever met.
Uh-huh.
And Larry would qualify.
Oh, okay.
He's gone now. He's passed away. He was my age, and he was a wild man. In fact, I used to tell my wife, Larry the Wild Man. He was one of the most unforgettable people. I'll tell you this particular story.
Mm-hmm.
It was his yellow twin-engine Cessna was flying low over the ocean and up the beach towards an excavation project where canals were being dug. 4 drag lines were dropping their buckets in and out, in and out, in and out of the water, and dredging up these canals.
Mm-hmm.
Larry sat in the co-pilot seat of the twin-engine Cessna, and he had a stopwatch in his hand. 22, 23, 24 seconds for number one. He was timing how long it took for the bucket to complete its cycle, to come out of the water, pivot, drop its load onto the beach, on the bank, and return to the water and come out again. The weekly winner who could do it the fastest won a stainless steel wristwatch with plenty of little dials on it.
Hmm.
Yes, it's the same Larry the Satyr, but now he's 35 years old, still good-looking and charming. Everyone working for Larry had been given a stopwatch as a gift.
Huh.
They had to wear them around their necks on a ribbon.
Interesting.
They didn't realize it, but Larry had made them extremely time conscious. They were timing everything. They went crazy and even timed their peas. The production on the canal job was beyond expectations and beyond projections. Larry was making a fortune. He was making big money in the Bahamas.
And what was Larry doing out there in the Bahamas?
Well, everything. He was dredging the harbor in Freeport, and he was building seawalls. He was helping in the division of the land into lots for sale, mostly to Europeans.
Oh, okay.
And that night I had dinner with Larry in the casino. And the casino manager treated us.
Mm.
Well, of course, I was the attorney for the casino.
Oh, so, okay. You had it in good.
Yeah. So he says, after dinner, he gets up, he says, Louis, that's how he used to call me. My name is Louis. Louis, I'm going to gamble. That's how Larry enjoyed pronouncing my name. He always did it. He stood up and he sauntered. He didn't walk. He sauntered up to the private blackjack table. And he spoke to the dealer. He says, I'll play 500 a card and take the whole table.
Wow. That's wild. How much is that?
Well, that's over $3,000 a hand.
Wow.
A hand. Now, my eyes were popping out. He played 6 or 7 hands all at once on this table. There were 3 decks of cards mixed into one another, and I had the feeling that even so, he could memorize the action and had a jump on the house. But he drew at 17 and went over. That means he asked for a card when the objective is to get to 21.
Without going over.
If you go over 21, you lose. And if you go under 21, if they are above you and still are under 21, you lose again.
Mm-hmm.
So he drew at 17 and went over.
Ugh.
Then he stuck at 17, and the dealer hit 19.
Ugh.
He lost, and he lost, and he lost. He was down about $125,000,
yikes,
and he turned to me.
Ugh.
He says, "Luis, please go up and get me 5,000 in chips." I said, "Larry, I'm the attorney here. I can't gamble. I don't have an account." "Luis, please go up and get me the chips." "Okay, I'll try, Larry, I'll try."
Oh.
So I walk up to the cashier's window.
And what happened then?
Well,
did you get the chips?
I said to the young girl, "May I have $5,000 in chips, please?" She was crisply dressed, a blonde, blue-eyed, mm-hmm, young lady. She looked at me and she said, "Yes, sir, Mr. Ress. Do you still keep an account at the Second National Bank?"
Oh, boy.
I said, "I do." She said, "Sign here. Here are your chips, sir."
Were you surprised there?
My teeth were dropping out. I was quite surprised. By the time it took me to write about it, Larry had lost that $5,000 too.
Oh, goodness.
And that was enough. Larry had was done gambling for the night.
Yes.
So he tipped the croupier or the dealer, and he told him to have the loss charged against his account at the casino. And then we went into the bar for a drink. Of course, the bartender wouldn't dream of charging us. And Larry didn't seem the slightest bit flustered. He talked about the great weather we were having and the latest group of girls he had met, but not one word about his losses. He told me that he was considering moving his three monster Manitowoc drag lines up to Kentucky to do some strip mining. And the mobilization cost, just moving them to Kentucky on these monster machines, was over $300,000.
Wow.
When we parted, he said, "Luis, I'll have your mark cleared before you leave the island on Wednesday." Now I know two things.
Yeah.
That I didn't have to concern myself about paying for the chips.
Good.
And that I would have been out of Freeport by Wednesday. Because he never told me. He used to say, "Come over here, I need you." And then I didn't know how long I would be there.
Right.
But
Now you had an out.
Yeah. I went to bed that night and I couldn't sleep. I kept thinking how cool it was to be unconcerned about losing over $130,000 in a few hours.
And he wasn't upset at all. You didn't see any sign of him being angry or bothered?
No, something wasn't right. I had seen much wealthier guys than Larry get aggravated over losing lesser amounts. And especially with the idea of losing. They get very upset with the idea of losing anything.
Yes.
These men are big egotists, very successful, and they could not accept the concept of losing.
It's about winning. They got to win.
Right.
Yeah.
They got to win on everything. So I didn't know if something was not right.
Mm-hmm.
And as sleep was approaching me, it came to me. Didn't Larry say, "Charge it on my account"? Well, he had an account at the casino.
Uh-huh.
And the casino was owned by Bahama Amusements. And Bahama Amusements was owned by Great Bahama Island Enterprises. And Larry was digging all of the canals for their residential development. They owed his company, E&B, INC, well over $3 million at a time.
Wow.
A good portion of which were profits and were subject to American income taxes.
Oh. So what did you figure out here?
Well, Larry was gambling with 50 cent pre-tax dollars. He could just say, "Take any losses off my account from what you owe me." So he wouldn't have to pay tax on his losses.
Skipped out on it.
And if he won, he would pocket the cash right at the casino, and it would be tax-free.
Great
strategy.
There were
no IRS agents in the Bahamas at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could gamble and take your profits, stick it in your pocket, and not show it.
That's great.
if he broke even, he was, in effect, converting taxable money into tax-free money and saving 50% or 50 cents on the dollar. And the cost, if he lost, was no greater than 6% of the casinos for the casino's profit. So, and also he was being entertained as a big spender.
Exactly. Well, that's pretty smart of him.
He's no dope. Don't tell me about Larry. You know, you talk about Harvard and Yale graduates, mm-hmm, and Cornell graduates. They worked for him. Larry never finished high school.
Yeah.
But he was smart.
What'd you do?
Well, I had a triple conflict of interest since my firm represented all of the entities involved.
Oh,
we represented the casino. We represented Larry. We represented the developer. So
you were in a tight squeeze there.
I just keep my mouth shut and make believe that I hadn't figured it out. But it didn't take long for my former partner, George Case, the president of Grand Bahama Island Enterprises, to come to his own conclusions, and Larry was no longer allowed to offset his casino account. It was great for Larry while it lasted.
So what was next for Larry after that?
Well, Larry was talking about moving these giant machines to Kentucky, and he in fact moved the three Manitowoc giant crawling excavating machines to Kentucky, right near Corbin, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
That meant getting permits to close the roads all the way up from Fort Lauderdale to Kentucky. The cabs of these excavating giants were the size of a small house. I had looked at the contract before he signed up to strip mine the side of a Kentucky mountain, and he was going to use these Manitowocs to do it. It was winter when he negotiated the deal, and he had gone on the property, and he had also looked at it from the air, and of course it was winter, the snow was 3 feet deep. I warned Larry to make sure that the subsoil conditions would support these huge machines. They weighed about 8,000 tons each.
Yeah.
They're huge.
What does a lawyer do with coal mining?
Well, that's an interesting question, because you would think that the lawyers don't get involved in coal mining contracts. They don't. It's very rare. It's a highly specialized area. In fact, I was the only attorney, to my knowledge, in the state of Florida that did coal mining contracts.
Huh.
I didn't because of Larry.
Right.
That,
you made the exception with him.
Yeah, you know, we learned a lot. We checked the seams of coal that ran under the property, their depth, and the yardages which could be mined, and we made sure that the contract protected Larry. So they're like rivers. They're like roads, and there's maps of them, and you learn how, where they are and how to read the map and where they run and how much of it is on the particular property that you're contracting for, and you can project the cubic yards of coal that can be mined.
Okay.
The owner produced certified core borings. That's when you drill in to the ground and you take a core out, and it shows you the area of the coal at the different levels, the different depths, so
okay.
that you can measure how far down the deep down the coal is and how far down it runs.
Huh.
And he confirmed the soil structure and the coal quality and the coal quantity. You check it. So sorting of the coal, transportation of the coal to rail cars, and a contract to sell to the utility company was all in line. You have to know what you're going to do with the coal when you get it out,
right.
how you're going to get it to the market,
mm-hmm.
and how you're going to sell it. And we were permitted. We had to get permits from the government entities, and we had to comply with the labor laws.
Hmm.
That
right.
was all done. There was a million things you had to do
to get it
running.
Before
you could get a client to open the doors, get the rights to mine, open the doors, mine it, sell it, and close it.
Yeah.
And there was closing up, too. You had to repair the property because you were strip mining.
Yeah.
So
it's a lot of work.
Larry had no other use for these huge excavators, the Manitowocs at the time. So I thought it was a very smart deal. He's a very smart guy. I was concerned about the law in Kentucky, about if we had a problem there, an argument or a dispute.
Yeah.
Because Kentucky is a very tight little state, and we were in a rural area.
Mm-hmm.
And I know justice in a rural area is not hard, not easy to obtain. So I put in a dispute resolution clause, and I put in for arbitration with the American Arbitration Association, and that would keep us out of local politics.
Good,
because they're vicious there. Well, Kentucky did not allow arbitration in those days.
Oh.
So what was I doing putting in an arbitration clause?
Right.
Malpractice.
Oh.
Well, you have to know what you're doing in order to avoid making a mistake, but accomplishing your goal. And this is what I tell attorneys. It's easy to say no.
Yeah.
It's harder to find a way to do something. And if it's illegal, find a legal way of doing it.
Yes.
So we have very little to lose. And I put in a clause saying the American Arbitration Association would have jurisdiction.
Okay.
And I knew that I was taking a chance, because it was going to say this was a federal issue and not a state issue.
I see.
So I felt I had a good chance of getting the arbitration clause enforced. And of course, it didn't take long for the phone to ring, and it was Larry.
Ha!
Luis, we got ourselves a big problem. That first Manitowoc has kept sinking into the ground. We get it straightened up, and she crawls a bit and sinks again. I said, Larry, it sounds to me as if the property has been undermined, shaft mined.
Yeah.
That would cause it to break down. He says, Luis, that can't be. I have certificates of the subsoil conditions and the core borings. I said, Larry, you better get the property core bored again. It sounds fishy to me. In other words, you go down and you make some more borings and make sure the coal's there.
What's a core boring? What is that exactly?
That's when you have, like, you drill a pipe down for a well, for water. You drill a pipe down and you pull it up. You've seen it on television when they do this in the Antarctic, and they drill, take cores of the ice, and they look for different things or sediments and things to see if there was a fire or a problem. And you can read the history by taking a core boring. So that's what they did. 2 days later, we learned that the engineers that Larry employed were unable to get core borings.
Oh.
The drill went down into vacant space. The property had been shaft mined, and the tunnel entrances on the side of the mountains had been sealed and covered over with shrubs and obscured by the snow. The property was not strip mineable.
Oh, no.
We were defrauded. We were scammed.
That's terrible.
Well, there was no point in trying to continue to dig. We made our claims, and we were met by the owner's lawsuit in the local state court. The owner claimed that the property was mineable, had the requisite yardage of quality coal, and that we were in default. A quick check revealed that everybody up there was related. The judge was the attorney's cousin.
Oh.
The attorney was the owner's brother-in-law, and the stench was terrific.
Oh, boy. So you had a lot to lose. Well, Larry, mostly.
Larry did have a lot to lose. We had over $300,000 just in the mobilization costs alone to bring the Manitowoc up there, the Manitowoc machines. Then there were all the fees, labor charges, administrative costs that we had engendered. And then, of course, all the loss of the projected profits. Our local attorney filed a motion in court to enforce the arbitration clause, and it was summarily denied.
Oh, no.
And they said, we don't have arbitration in Kentucky. What are you doing? You know, it's,
oh, boy.
It's a no-brainer.
What'd you do at that point?
Well, I called Larry. And I said, Larry, I need the Learjet. He had his own jet.
Huh.
I need it for a day. I'm going to go file for arbitration with the American Association, Arbitration Association in Cincinnati. And then I'll fly to Little Rock, and I'll seek an emergency injunction against the Kentucky State Court. We also have to ask the court to enforce the arbitration clause under the Federal Arbitration Act.
Wow, there's a lot going on there. Can you explain all that? You had a lot of work to do. So
yeah, I had to unravel the knot.
Mm.
I had to get us out of the state court in Kentucky and into federal court in Arkansas.
Yes.
So my first stop was in Corbin, Kentucky, where I filed a notice for arbitration and a motion to stay the proceedings. And to hold up. Then I took copies of the petition, which we were filing in federal court, and I served them in the state court in Arkansas to show them that we were going into federal court to hold everything. Our local attorney was very skeptical. He said, Lewis, I think you're going to be in trial right here in court. I think that's what's going to happen.
Oh, no.
Now, Larry's jet plane was waiting at the airport, and I flew off to Cincinnati. And the co-pilot called ahead for a cab at the executive airport. And when the taxi crossed over the bridge into Ohio, I felt a great sense of relief. The clerk at the American Arbitration Association office refused to accept our petition, our application. And he said, Kentucky does not permit arbitration, and we cannot process your claim for arbitration.
Oh, clerks can be nasty. What did you do?
Well, I asked to speak to the office director, and again it became an argument. I finally explained to the director of the office that we were appealing to the Federal District Court for a ruling under the Federal Arbitration Act, which should prevail over the Kentucky state law and would allow arbitration, and that his office was the proper place to file. This would be a huge crack in the Kentucky prohibition of arbitration law and would open his office to a flood of arbitrations. Usually there's a very hefty charge for filing a multi-million dollar claim, But the director was so convinced that we would be unsuccessful and wasting our time and his time that he charged me a token of $200. I walked away with a certified copy of the filing of the arbitration.
Was that a good deal for you?
Oh, man, it was some deal. That thing should have been thousands of dollars
wow.
to file that claim. So I already paid for the jet and the day and everything.
Great.
And my fee. The jet landed in Little Rock. That was our next stop.
Mm-hmm.
It was sunny. And this time they had a limo take me to the courthouse.
Nice.
I was going up. Evidently, the co-pilot was getting respect for me.
Uh-huh.
And my petition for an emergency ex parte hearing, that means right now, without anyone else being involved, for an injunction, was accepted along with all of my other documents because they were properly prepared. And the judge was in the process of hearing a motion, but I was allowed to come into the impressive courtroom and wait.
And what's all that about?
Well, it's about the federal judge stopping everything in the court in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
So I never ceased to be awed by federal courtrooms. This one was two stories high with ceilings, with polished wood benches, heavy draperies, thick carpeting, and an elevated judge's podium, all in wood, beautifully carved with American flags and eagles all carved
wow.
into it. They really know how to live.
Yeah.
And the judge spoke to me. He said, "Mr. Riss, what's this all about?" I said, "Your Honor, we are seeking an ultimate determination by this court that the Federal Arbitration Act supersedes the Kentucky state law prohibiting arbitration. We are petitioning to stop the Kentucky state court in Corbin from going forward in a pending lawsuit until this court has the opportunity to consider and rule on our motion to compel arbitration pursuant to the Federal Arbitration Act." In other words, we're asking him to stop everything in Kentucky,
yes.
tell the state court, a federal court tells the state court in another state
mm-hmm.
to hold it, don't do anything. And he says, "Do you have a proposed order?" I said, "Yes, Your Honor, it's included in the file which we've submitted." He says, "I see it. It's granted. The clerk will advise us to the date of the argument. So this is just a temporary stay, hold up in Kentucky, until the federal court has a chance to listen to it."
Mm-hmm. And what was the result of all this lawyering you were doing?
Well, we actually stopped the Kentucky court from going forward. And they were really angry. They were ticked off.
Oh, yeah,
the locals were really upset about the outsiders telling their courts that they couldn't
mm-hmm.
go forward. And Larry's machines, he had all kinds of bulldozers and everything else, they were being fired on by rifle shots from the woods.
Oh, wow.
They shot out the tires on a number of them. And we suspected that it was the owner's employees, you know, the guy that was selling us the property or leasing us the property.
Yeah.
Within a week, we had a date to argue in Arkansas. Larry's jet was waiting for me. Special permission had been granted for me to appear as co-counsel with a local Little Rock attorney. The owner's attorneys came in from Corbin, and they were there with local counsel also. And the owner was there himself. John Stencil was his name. He turned out to be a grubby, heavy-set roughneck.
Huh. And was there a hearing?
Oh, yeah. There was a hearing. It was 3 p.m. when we were called into the main courtroom to argue. My local guy was not presenting our case in a clear and distinct manner. He was making a convoluted argument, and he was being interrupted by the seller's attorney at the end of every sentence. And that's a whole tactic.
Ugh.
Keep interrupting. Jab, jab, jab. It's like a boxing match. Don't let the fellow have a thought, follow through on his thought.
Right.
Break his train of thought. Don't let the judge get a sense of what he's trying to argue.
Wow.
Finally, the judge told them all to be quiet. Judge was no fool.
Mm-hmm.
The judge said, "Mr. Riss, you file this petition. You explain what's going on here." I said, "Your Honor, this is a question of whether federal law prevails over conflicting state law." Boy, the federal judges love to hear that federal law prevails over state law. So I had his attention. And I continued, "My client contracted to dig coal in Kentucky to be loaded onto rail cars and to ship them to Ohio and Arkansas and many other states. This very coal is used by various state utilities to produce electricity, which is on the national grid. We are engaged in interstate commerce. This is a classic interstate commerce situation. This mining contract influences and is a direct part of interstate commerce. The contract specifically provides for arbitration of disputes with the American Arbitration Association and comes under the Federal Arbitration Act. We have filed with the American Arbitration Association. We are being sued in Kentucky, and we respectfully ask that you determine that we are entitled to arbitration and compel the Kentucky court to honor and enforce any arbitration award which results from this federal arbitration.
And what happened after that?
2 days later, the federal judge ruled in our favor and said that we were entitled to arbitrate.
Wonderful.
So back to Cincinnati now for the appointment of an arbitrator. This is quite a story about corruption and dishonesty.
Yeah.
The American Arbitration Association manager was quite surprised. At a brief hearing, he selected Corbin as the place for arbitration and named the arbitrator. Well, when I got back to the office, I looked up the arbitrator, and his address seemed to be familiar to me. It was on the same street as Stenzel's attorney, the owner of the property.
Yeah.
It was only two numbers different. You know, often attorneys have offices close to one another near the courthouse, but I had to investigate. Mm-hmm. Sure enough, they each occupied one side of a duplex with connecting doors. The arbitrator had been a former partner of the seller's attorney. They were still in a number of real estate deals together. Neither attorney nor the named mediator disclosed this. Clearly, the manager had appointed an arbitrator handpicked by Stenzel's attorney.
Yep.
Maybe the manager was bribed. Maybe he was thinking of future sources of business, or was another country cousin, or was unhappy about the $200 filing fee.
Mm-hmm.
We'll never know, but he sure had to know what he was doing.
Yes.
It had a terrible stench to it.
Yeah.
This time, we demanded arbitration in Lexington, Kentucky, and I asked that the arbitrators be appointed from the official arbitrators list using a short list of three, and these were going to be the judges, the arbitrators.
Yes, yes.
Each party had a veto, and there were three arbitrators from the list, and we could each knock off one,
mm-hmm.
and that would leave one left. They agreed, and we finally had an arbitrator. So now I found a Harvard Law School graduate, an older gentleman, but very sharp, to be lead counsel in Lexington, Kentucky, because I couldn't practice there. I wasn't admitted there.
Right.
And politically, it would have been suicide.
Yeah.
So this guy knew everybody, and he was a charming, very competent lawyer.
And what happened next?
Well, the arbitration comes up for a hearing,
mm-hmm.
and we present our claim in front of the arbitrator, and Stenzel's lawyers produced experts who said that the property was not undermined and that they based their opinion on engineering borings, and there was enough quality coal throughout the property to satisfy the contract's gross requirements. Their engineer was a major firm with Georgia Tech graduates in Atlanta, Georgia, and when we contacted them, they said that the studies were valid and done under their supervision, that they had subcontracted it out. And that was their sworn testimony. So Stenzel, after numerous delays, had to produce his business records, which we received only after the first day of the arbitration.
Huh.
He finally produced them.
Wow.
And that night I looked over them. I was in a motel, and I reviewed his canceled checks, and I noticed a check payable recently, check payable to Billy Corbett of Kerrville, Texas, for $3,000 without an explanation or a memo on it. Billy answered the phone at about 9 o'clock at night. After I introduced myself, Billy said, "Oh, I had a feeling you might find me. Boy, am I relieved. I can't be a party to a fraud. I'm a well driller here in Kerrville, and Atlantic Engineering hired me to find coal on the Corbin property. I went out there and I explained to Mr. Stenzel that I was getting dry holes all over the place and that the property had been undermined.
Yes.
He said that there were columns which I should find and I should drill into the columns to find coal. Each of the 20 positive borings I made throughout the property was obtained only after I probed to locate the columns that supported the roof of the excavation. All of the other 62 borings went into empty caverns or dry holes, and they were supposed to be disregarded as though they never happened."
Well, his records would really be helpful in this case.
Yeah, I said, "What about your records?" He says, "I don't have a journal. I have nothing in writing." Atlanta Engineering made out the report, and I'm embarrassed to tell you that I don't read or write, but I do remember every single hole I drilled.
Wow.
And he did. His testimony was devastating. He couldn't read or write, but what a memory.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to describe any of the 82 holes that he had drilled, including the date, the exact location, and the results obtained. And he diagrammed them on a big map.
Oh, that's great.
And Stenzel's attorneys couldn't shake him. He told of Stenzel instructing him to discard and forget about all of the dry holes and not report them to Atlanta Engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Stenzel had defrauded Larry. He had defrauded Atlanta Engineering. And the award was over $3 million against Stenzel personally, as well as his company for fraud.
Yeah.
The Kentucky State Court reluctantly issued a judgment against him for over $3 million. We levied on whatever assets we could find, and we setting aside his evasive attempts to hide recent transfers and to create liens on his company's property, but there still was a large uncollectible balance.
And what did you do?
Well, Larry said just to write it off. He came out fine. He got all his money back
yeah.
with a profit and all his expenses. But I was angry as hell at Stenzel and his attorneys and the conspiring cousins all through
mm-hmm.
Kentucky and Ohio. What a bad bunch. And I wasn't going away so fast. I was really angry about what the Arbitration Association did to me and trying
yes.
to rig up the arbitrator and he and Stenzel's attorneys being a part of it. Stenzel filed a personal bankruptcy, and I wasn't going away so fast. I countered that the arbitration award was non-dischargeable in bankruptcy since it was based on fraud.
Good.
And the
yep.
bankruptcy court agreed with me and ruled that the judgment was not dischargeable.
And could you collect from Stenzel?
I brought that son of a gun in to my office in for questioning on his assets semi-annually, twice
Good.
A year, and in Little Rock. And our attorney in Little Rock, where Stenzel lived, noticed that he was wearing a diamond studded Rolex.
Oh.
So he says, you know, in Arkansas, you can try a body execution. You can levy on a human, a body,
oh.
and take what's on it. And so we did. I was really angry. I didn't care what it cost.
Yeah.
I had the sheriff stop Stenzel in the main street of Little Rock and impound the Rolex plus $300 in cash in his pocket and deliver it to the clerk of the federal court. Stenzel and his attorney appear in federal court to argue that the watch belonged to his wife, who was a jeweler, and that it was on consignment.
Huh.
And the judge leaned over the bench and said, I never heard a worse liar and bullshitter in my life. And that was the federal judge in open court. It was a $13,000 watch, and I used the $300 in cash to pay the costs. And I gave the watch to the attorney as a gift.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't money. This was a vendetta.
Yeah.
So thereafter, once a year, every year, I brought Stenzel in, sometimes twice a year. He couldn't own anything in his name. He couldn't go into a business. I had him list his assets and produce his income tax every year. Even after Larry died, I kept renewing the judgment every 20 years. When it was about to expire, I renewed it. And before Larry died, he said, Louis, enough is enough, Luis. Let him go. And I didn't think this lying, conniving bastard should get the best of Larry or me.
Mm-hmm.
Until finally, after 15 years, Stenzel came in and he apologized. The smartest thing he ever did.
Yeah.
And he raised some funds to settle the balance. And I followed Larry's instructions. And I took the money from the settlement and made a charitable donation in Larry's memory.
Wow, what a story. There's
yeah,
a lot.
I didn't charge a fee.
There's a lot to learn here.
Yeah, there is. There's always a lot to learn. There's always a moral to the story. The first moral in this story is keep double checking.
Mm-hmm.
Look before you leap. So isn't that a wonderful story? Look before you leap. I once was told I could jump off a rock while skiing because it was 10 feet of powder below the rock.
Yeah.
It's a 30-foot drop. And I decided I wasn't going to leap. I was going to look.
Yeah.
And sure enough, there was a hot water stream coming out below that rock, and it was all gravel and rocks. I would have died.
No, yeah, yeah. It would have been
suicide. So I literally looked before I left.
Yeah.
And that's what you have to do in business. You have to do, they call it due diligence. You got to do your due diligence. Sometimes it's hard. But I told Larry to check for undermining.
He did.
He should have had some test core borings done just to check on his own.
Yeah.
But he relied on what he was given. Sometimes you can't rely on what you're given.
Hmm.
And people are judgment proof. A lot of people get away with the collectability on a judgment is very important. If you can't collect against somebody, what's the point in papering your wall with judgments?
Hmm.
They're meaningless. It doesn't help the client or yourself. And you go bankrupt taking cases where you lay out costs in your time and you can't collect.
Yeah.
So Larry made a mistake. Well, businessmen make a lot of mistakes. Sometimes you can't contemplate the mistake. For example, you come up with a terrific product and you're making a fortune and you go bankrupt. Why? Because your orders exceed your ability to produce.
Hmm.
One of the suppliers, it's happening now. You can't
yes.
get a particular part or a particular component.
Yes.
And so you can't turn out your final product, whether it's a Tesla automobile or a computer.
Yeah.
And can't get chips. And
chips.
You go bankrupt because you've got contracts that you can't meet, or the prices of some of the raw materials that you need to use, like lumber or something in building a house or an office building or commercial building, the lumber prices double.
Yeah.
So you've got to contract for all of that before you sign
you
a
have
contract
to, count everything,
to commit
yeah.
to produce something at a fixed price.
Yes.
Those people make lots of mistakes. Do businessmen make mistakes often? You bet they do. Famous businessmen?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I checked. You know me. I looked up Warren Buffett.
Mm-hmm.
You know who Warren Buffett is?
Yeah, of course.
He's my kind of guy.
Yeah.
I like Warren Buffett. He's a straight shooter.
Yeah.
And he admits that he doesn't pay enough taxes. He's a good guy. Well, Warren Buffett sold off. He owned Apple, a lot of Apple stock.
Uh-huh.
He sold off a small part of his Apple stock. And lost $200 billion because it went up
wow.
in value. He sold at the wrong time. He had ConocoPhillips. He bought them at a high price and lost a fortune because crude oil was over $100 a barrel at the time he bought the oil company and went all the way down. He bought Dexter Shoes in 1993. Ever hear of Dexter Shoes? No one has.
Nope.
He lost $3.5 billion on that deal.
Wow.
Oh, that's Warren Buffett. You ever hear of Carl Icahn?
Nope.
Carl Icahn was very famous. He was the corporate raider.
Okay.
And he bought Blockbuster. He paid 26 cents a share and sold at 8 cents a share.
Oh.
And he because Netflix came in.
Yeah.
He lost 98% of his investments.
Wow.
On that deal alone. So Carl Fisher, I've told you about before, Miami Beach.
Yes.
And he lost a fortune. There were others. The developer of Carl Gables went bankrupt. Well, here's a guy I'm going to tell you about. I'm not going to mention his name, but I'll tell you about him, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then you tell me who it is.
Okay.
No, you won't tell me. You won't be sued.
Okay.
He started a game, like a Monopoly board game,
uh-huh.
And with his name on it,
mm-hmm.
that went bankrupt. He had a premium vodka named after him. That went bankrupt. He started a magazine with his name on it. That went bankrupt.
He didn't take the hint, huh?
he opened a travel booking site. Go blank with his name on it. That went bankrupt. He was involved in, here's the one that'll tell you who it is. He was involved in a number of casinos that went bankrupt in New Jersey, including the Taj Mahal.
Oh.
He had an airline that lasted 2 years and went bankrupt in his name. He had a redevelopment program that he was supposed to do in Manhattan's West Side that never went through. He had a mortgage company in his own name. Blank mortgage company in 2006. It lasted 1 year and went bankrupt. He had a clothing line for menswear. He's still selling it, but when he was thrown out of Macy's. He had a university named after him. Now that's a dead giveaway in 2005. And he was sued for $40 million by the New York Attorney General for fraud in the university.
Mm-hmm.
And he settled with the students for $25 million and closed the university
wow.
in his name. And now he has a line of steaks that he sells at different clubs that he owns. And they found out the wrapping on the steak had someone else's name on it. And all he's
Ha.
doing is taking someone else's steaks
Oh,
and repackaging
goodness.
them. That's pretty close to fraud.
Ha.
Anyhow,
He's got quite a streak.
huh?
He has quite the streak there.
Yeah, that's they made mistakes. If you haven't figured out who it is,
I haven't, but we'll talk about it
you
after the
can't don't mention
podcast.
his name. We talk something else about Larry and the Manitowocs, because I mentioned the Manitowoc machine, and you didn't seem
Those are
to.
massive.
Yeah,
Yes.
I thought I'd tell you a little bit about Manitowocs, because they have a number of machines. These things, they have a mouth, a bucket. The bucket is big enough, like to take two automobiles in it at one draw.
Wow.
Can pull up something like that, and it's a crawler dragline excavator. The bucket is like 16 cubic yards.
Wow. You're huge.
It's yeah, the boom on these things, it can go hundreds of feet, 160 feet, 200 feet. These booms, they're almost half the size of a football field, and they balance them off. They have counterweights, and this thing, the cab is like a house.
Wow.
You
Yeah, imagine,
walk.
and then he mentioned that one of them was sinking in. So imagine trying to lift that thing out.
I mean, these things, they weigh 500 tons, some of them.
Yeah.
I told you the weight there was like 8,000 tons, but they go much higher. This is the kind of a machine, and I hate to tell you, there's different numbers. Manitowoc actually manufactures them. There's the 6400, there's the 4500, the 4600. 4600 goes back to 1994. These are used internationally. They're not just used, and they're used for huge mining operations, strip mining. They're used out of the country. They're used in Saudi Arabia
Yes.
they drag out sand and things. They're enormous, and they're very, very expensive. Now, that gives you a little bit of an insight. And I talk about strip mining. I didn't tell you anything about that. Strip mining is a really murderous way of digging out coal, which I'm against to start with. And we're talking about soft coal, not anthracite. We're talking about bituminous coal, which is polluting.
Yeah.
It's like peat. It pollutes. You have to clear the topsoil, and when you do that, it causes erosion. The rain comes, and it washes down the soil, and then all kinds of sediments get into the soil, and it goes into the waterways, and you get minerals, and you get all kinds of
Yeah.
iron oxide, and it destroys the fish and the game
Toxic.
and the property. You can't rehabilitate it. Even if you replant it, the seeds won't
Still
take.
there, yeah.
The soil is really pernicious. It's terrible. It's a terrible way. Minerals get into it. And then, I don't know if you know anything about underground fires. Nobody knows. I thought I'd bring that up because,
That's pretty
in
crazy.
passing, doing coal mining deals, nobody understands the danger of an underground fire. An underground fire is particularly related to coal. Sometimes it could be methane. Well, methane is a gas that comes from part of it comes from coal mining. It's 20 times more toxic than CO2, and it's a terrible thing. It pollutes the atmosphere, and it's much more dangerous than carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide, and it really makes it very it comes from strip mining. And then, of course, I tell you about the scars on the landscaping. You can't reseed. Everybody says, "Oh, we're going to reseed it. We're going to build it back." It doesn't work. The soil is damaged, and the reseeding is very, very ineffective and difficult. And then I was talking to you about the underground fires.
Yes.
A fire starts underground. especially in a coal seam where it's been excavated, and there's an opening, and it can go on. You won't believe it. It can go on for thousands of years.
No.
Thousands of years.
Wow.
Yeah, and no
just
one talks
the fire
about
keeps
it.
Just burning.
There's no rain. There's no snow. You can't put it out. It keeps burning. It's the most probably persistent fire on Earth. And
I'm sure it spreads, right?
Yeah, sure. The worst one is in Australia.
Hmm.
It's called Burning Mountain.
Wow.
Burning Mountain. Yeah,
the whole place is on fire.
The whole inside the mountain is burning, and they can't stop it.
Goodness.
It's caused by self-heating, oxidation. Lightning will cause it. Wildfires, arson. Negligence in, mm-hmm. when you're doing excavations.
Because once you technically, after you do it, you're supposed to seal everything, right? So that to prevent anything from
right,
entering or escaping.
Right. It's a wildfire can cause it.
Yeah.
Arson, oxidation. It's damage, very damaging to the atmosphere. The toxic fumes come
the fumes,
up from the
yeah.
ground. Actually, 3% of the world's CO2 emissions come from underground fires.
Wow.
The underground fires produce 40 tons of mercury entering the atmosphere annually. 40 tons.
Oh, that's terrible.
So I thought I would just tell you a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
What else can I tell you? There's a lot of things I can tell you about. Let's talk about the beginning of the story where Larry has these stopwatches.
Yes.
He's
very obsessed with time.
Is that smart? Is that good business? You bet it's good business. There's a thing called time and motion studies in production. MBAs know all about that,
huh.
Where you have a factory and you time the job to different things that it takes, whether it's a machine to do it, a robot, or a human being. You time how long does it take and how does it function? And what does it cost me to have this function? And is it cheaper to have a human do it with some discretion or to have a robot do it? So you'll find some things that, like in a packing plant, they'll pack by hand. Other times they'll do machines.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not arbitrary.
They've done research.
Right.
Yep.
And a lot of this has to do with the attitude of the employees. If you have employees that are resentful and surly and angry and lazy, they take it out on you. If you have employees that are motivated, they work harder and they're happier.
Hmm.
So these things like giving a stopwatch and they're timing everything, they become time-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And they're working for you and they want to see how much they can do. They want to win that steel watch at the end of the week.
Yep.
That's a trophy that you win. And everyone walks around with that steel watch, say, hey, look what I won. Larry gave me this. That's a terrific thing to get competition. So I started to think about competition. Larry's really smart. Who else was smart? Napoleon.
Hmm.
Napoleon was
quite
a tremendous gentleman,
mm-hmm.
and he knew and a general, and he knew of, and he was ruthless, and he knew about awards. And he said, quote, give me enough medals and I'll win you any war, unquote. So what's medals? Medals boost morale. They're awards.
People like to
and
be recognized.
And dedication.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what are some of the medals? Well, everyone you know has a bowling trophy. So we all do that. We all look at, and everyone you see the bowling trophy on the mantelpiece or on the, in the, it's always in the living room or in the den.
They want to show it off. Yeah.
That's right. So some of the medals, talk about military medals. I started to think, I made a list of the ones I could remember. Well, the ones most important one in the American Army, I think, is the Purple Heart.
Mm-hmm.
The Purple Heart is when you're wounded in action, in combat. And if you get an oak leaf cluster on it, that means you got more than, that's the second one. They don't give you a second Purple Heart, they give you an oak leaf cluster.
Oh, wow.
A little piece of metal, like in the shape of an oak leaf that
uh-huh.
they put on the medal. Everyone gets a medal in the Army. Everyone gets a medal. There's a medal for 3 years good conduct.
Mm-hmm.
That means if you're an enlisted man and you stay out of trouble for 3 years, you get a medal. Everyone gets a medal.
For participation.
I couldn't get that because I wasn't an enlisted man. Then you have the ones for valor.
Mm-hmm.
the Bronze Star, which everyone, like in the Battle of the Bulge in Germany, everyone in that battle got the Bronze Star.
Hmm.
And that's a very prevalent thing, but it's a great thing to get the Bronze Star. Silver Star is even harder to get. That one you have to be bravery.
Okay.
Then you have the Distinguished Service Cross. Then you start into getting crosses. That's big. Religion comes
okay.
in. I'll tell you more about that. But the biggest medal at all is the Congressional Medal of Honor. Congressional Medal of Honor usually is awarded posthumously.
Mm.
Most of the recipients are dead. I think about 3,500 people, from what I can recall, have been awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Hmm.
And it goes on three bases, the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy. They have each have a different version of the same medal. Then there's the Congressional Medal of Honor. Then there's the Congressional Gold Medal. That sounds similar. That's given to civilians. That started in 1776, and that's awarded by the government, the president. Oh, also, I think Congress awards it, and they awarded it to the Capitol Police from from the riots in the June 6th riots. Then they have the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which they created in 1945, and the Presidential Citizens Medal of 1969. So they make up this crap, I mean these medals, and they award them. Rush Limbaugh got the medal given by President Trump at the time, President Trump. So it's a political thing that
gesture.
You can give to one of your favorite people
right.
and make them feel good. Now, you have in the Russia has the Hero of the Soviet Union and the Hero of Socialist Labor. And again, these are the red stars, you know, when they give them out, the Lenin thing and a picture of Lenin. And you wear that, people wear that on their clothing, the civilian clothing in Russia.
Wow.
You walk around and you see them wearing a double-breasted suit with medals on it.
Okay.
Very important. The biggest medal in England is the Victoria Cross. That's for valor in the presence of the enemy. The French Legion of Honor. I started to think of all these medals, but the world is loaded with medals. That was awarded in 1802 by Napoleon. He created the Legion of Honor, and they have different degrees. You can be a knight, you can be an officer, you can be a commander, and only French people can get the fifth degrees. You know, a non-French can be awarded merit of Legion, but they don't become an actual member.
Oh, okay.
The Iron Cross in Germany, in the Third Reich, you know, for Hitler. Well, now they changed it around. That one originally was a Prussian medal. It goes back to 1813. And they become a knight of the Iron Cross. And that was Hitler. But now they changed it, and they changed the name of the medal, and they did away with it.
Good.
Yeah, that's good. Those are just some of the medals. Then you have religious medals. You know anything? Well, you're Catholic. You ought to know.
I'm not Catholic.
You're not?
No.
I thought you were born Catholic.
No, I'm not.
Oh, I thought you were Cuban.
Yeah, no, I'm not Catholic.
Okay, I'm surprised. anyhow, they have St. Christopher medals. You know what they are?
Nope.
I thought you would be able to talk to me about these
nope.
medals. I was all counting on you.
Sorry.
Well, St. Christopher medal used to be the statue you put up in the car. You wore the medal to protect you from having an automobile accident.
Oh, St. Christopher's with
very
cars
popular.
Accidents.
Finally, the Vatican said no more of that stuff. That's mumbo jumbo. And we're not, you don't put a thing up. They don't want you to put a statue up in your car to protect you. Pay attention to driving. And
is it? And I think there's one too, like to help you find a parking space or something. It seems like there's a saint for everything.
Yeah, there is. Well, everybody has a patron saint, and then you have personal medals, religious medals, and then you have the miraculous medals. They're all for protection. You have the Saint Benedict medals. So these are devotional, and they're reminders, and they're for protection. And it's wonderful. Then you get, I was just talking to you about, so you had the military medals, and we talk about religious medals. And they have them in every religion. And then you have commercial medals, and you have sports.
Mm-hmm. And literary
you have
ones,
entertainment.
Too. Literary ones. Huh? Literary ones.
Yeah, oh,
well.
Yeah, the Nobel Prize and
yeah.
the Pulitzer Prize.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. And they're very big. Then every society has medals. You know, the Society of, or the Guild of Engineers, or Society of Space Development.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have their clubs and societies, their Workers' Compensation Society of America, whatever. And they give away these plaques and medals. It's a big business. You have in entertainment, you have the Oscar and the
mm-hmm.
Emmy and the Grammy, right?
Yeah.
Sports, horse racing, America's Cup, boat racing, the Olympics. So what do you think the biggest medals or the biggest trophies are in the world physically?
The Stanley Cup is pretty big.
You're so smart. Are you smart? The Stanley Cup is 88.5 centimeters. That's
wow.
how big it is. How would I know that? That's right. Golf,
mm-hmm.
the Dubai Desert Classic. That trophy is 108 centimeters. That's bigger than the Stanley Cup.
Wow.
Wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
The Emperor's Cup, the sumo wrestlers get these things. They have 65 pounds of silver.
It's got to match, right?
In the wrestling cup.
It's got to match them.
In the wrestling cup. The Indy 500, they have the Borg Warner Trophy. That's another one that's, I think, over 100 centimeters. America's Cup, 110 centimeters. Horse racing, is they get all these trophies. Shooting, the NRA gives you trophies. You can send in your scores, you know, your bullseyes,
uh-huh.
Your targets, and they send you a medal in the mail.
Oh, wow.
And patches also. And Canadian football, the Grey Cup. The Grey Cup Canadian football is 117 centimeters. These are big. These are big. Soccer, the Costa del Sol soccer trophy is 120 centimeters.
Wow.
Yeah, the Kalanka Cup, that's the tallest one. That's polo in India, the polo award in India.
Wow.
That is 6 feet tall.
Yikes.
So,
these things can be big.
Yeah, so I've given you a whole bunch of medals and trophies and competition and prizes. The bottom line being that Larry was very smart to... give them these watches.
Mm-hmm.
He came up on his own. He didn't bring in a consulting firm, but that's one of the ways to do things. So in your office, you have a picture. The employee of the month gets to park in the parking spot.
Right.
The manager of the year gets his picture put up.
It's like a wall of
right.
recognition.
You get a certificate.
Mm-hmm.
You get a free trip sometimes. You'll get a trip to Las Vegas or to the Bahamas or whatever. A cruise. Now they give away cruises.
Yeah.
So it's all motivational.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you get the best results. Okay. And Larry was smart enough to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. He was quite a smart guy overall.
Right. So did you like that?
Yeah. Great
that
story. Thank you so much for sharing, Lewis.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Don't forget to like our Facebook page, Miami Memoirs, and be sure to pick up a copy of Lewis Ress's new book on Amazon.